This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Jack Matlock was U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1987 until 1991. During a Foreign Service career that spanned 35 years, he served four tours in the USSR and several years in Washington dealing with Soviet and European affairs. Since retiring, he's held several academic positions, most recently with Duke University. Ambassador Matlock was in Cincinnati this week for the Greater Cincinnati World Affairs Council Speakers Series, America Faces Its Global Challenges. I spoke with him about lessons from the Cold War and how they can apply to public policy today. Ambassador Matlock, thanks for joining me today. How did you come to be the ambassador to the Soviet Union?
It was the result, I think, of a number of things. One, I had specialized in the Russian language and the Soviet Union even before I entered the Foreign Service. Second, before I was ambassador, I had three tours at our embassy in Moscow and had worked as director of Soviet affairs in the State Department and then as Reagan's principal advisor on Soviet and European affairs, so that by that time, I was sort of the most senior officer in the Foreign Service who dealt primarily with the Soviet Union. You know, none of that is automatic in the final analysis. The president decides whom he names. In this case, having worked with him in the White House, it was sort of natural for him to send me to Moscow as ambassador when my predecessor's tour was up.
That final year you were ambassador to the Soviet Union is also the same year that the Soviet Union broke apart.
Yes.
What were the key factors that led to that breakup of the Soviet Union?
Yes. The breakup occurred actually when Gorbachev, the then Soviet leader, tried to reform the system and to make it more democratic.
That was what he called glasnost, I believe.
Well, it started with glasnost, which really means more transparency. In other words, more openness. Then it became perestroika. Perestroika is reconstruction or reform. With foreign policy, he called it the new thinking. And the combination of these was that, first of all, he understood you needed to end the arms race because it was killing them economically. And we really had to end the Cold War before he could begin to reform the Soviet Union. So the two went sort of hand in hand. And the more reforms he had at home, the easier it was for us to settle problems. Actually, the end of the Cold War allowed, which we negotiated, they were not defeated. Every agreement we made was in their interest. But it allowed him to begin to try to change the system fundamentally. But the pressures internally were such that it really, you know, caused it to fall apart. One of the factors was nationalism, the non-Russian nationalism of the non-Russian peoples. The Soviet Union had only barely 50% Russians. The rest were other nationalities. And they were, you know, often living in their ancestral lands. Then there was a failing economy. The Soviet economy didn't work very well. And as you tried to reform it, it began to collapse altogether. And then, of course, there was the political problems. As Gorbachev was trying to take the Communist Party out of power, most people don't realize that that's what happened. The leader of the Communist Party was the one who actually reduced their power. Then the elements in the party and the military, the KGB, began to resist this. So all of these internal factors, once there was peace, Cold War was over, no hostility, East Europe went free, and suddenly the pressures inside simply caused it to break up. led by Russia, by the way, the elected leader of Russia, Boris Yeltsin. And that's a story in itself, the way the relationship of the two of them developed. At one point, Gorbachev had forced Yeltsin out of the Communist Party leadership. But as he developed more democratic ways, then Yeltsin began to win elections. It became almost a mortal rivalry. So once Yeltsin was elected president of Russia, which at that time was just part of the Soviet Union, he had an incentive for breaking up the Soviet Union in order to get rid of Gorbachev.
Sounds like these two men were the right combination of leaders for all this to occur.
Yes. You know, it was our policy at the time, I'm speaking now, 1991, to encourage them to work together. We did not want to see the Soviet Union break up, a whole lot of reasons. So the idea that somehow we forced the breakup, which some people have, is absolutely wrong. Mm. We wanted the three Baltic countries to regain their independence. But the other 12, we would have been happy to see stay in a voluntary federation.
What was, I think I've read where you say that some people view the breakup as solely a victory for the West and for America. But you say that's not the case.
That's not the case. Yeah. Absolutely not the case. As a matter of fact, when George Bush, the President Bush, visited Kiev on August 1st, 91. He advised the Ukrainians and implicitly the other non-Russians to agree to Gorbachev's voluntary federation or confederation, which they were talking about then, and he warned against suicidal nationalism. And he also said, freedom and independence are not synonymous. Choose freedom. Because with the sort of reforms that were going, it was going to be much easier to for them to deal with their problems if they kept a certain unity. We see the results now, 25 years later, when they didn't.
Now, what's your assessment of Russia today? 26 years since the breakup of the Soviet Union. How do you view Russia today?
Well, first of all, it's a capitalist country. It's not communist. It no longer has, a messianic call to spread communism in the world. This is very basic, because that's what the Cold War was really about. On the other hand, Russia went through an extremely traumatic period in the 1990s, where most people's lives took a real plunge. And they didn't have democracy. They had near anarchy. And so that as things have gotten back more normal, when you go to Moscow or St. Petersburg now, those cities, they're like other West European cities in most respects. It's not like the Soviet Union at all. In many respects, Russia is doing very well culturally and in many other respects, particularly in cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. The rural areas, again, in many cases, things are getting worse. On the other hand, for Russia is once again, as it was historically, a food exporter. You know, during the Soviet Union, they were buying over 20 million tons of grain a year, even though Ukraine was part of it and Ukraine was their largest grain producer. Now, without Ukraine, Russia has become a grain exporter. It shows how, you know, the system has the capitalist system they has now has turned out to be much more productive than the Soviet system. So that there are many aspects that life is freer. In the Soviet Union, only a handful of people were allowed to travel abroad, for example. they couldn't even travel freely within the Soviet Union. Much of the area was closed for security reasons. Now, a large portion of the population routinely takes their holiday in Italy or Greece or whatnot, and a fair number also in the United States. So, and if you have the money, you can travel anywhere you want. This is one of the most prized freedoms. So the idea that somehow they are unfree today, I mean, to a person who knew how things were in the Soviet Union, that just doesn't ring true.
So they're freer than they were.
Yeah, they have freedoms. Now, of course, they've got political problems, and the government does control most of the media, but not all. There's still a reasonable freedom of speech. And, you know, I was just in St. Petersburg 2 weeks ago, and you could pick up books that were quite anti-Putin and anti-current government in the bookshops. It's not like the Soviet Union that things don't get published unless it's approved. But compared to the past, things are, I would say, much improved. They do have problems. The birth rate is comparatively low, so the actual Russian population is declining in numbers, and that worries them. That's one thing. Of course, the same thing is happening in Western Europe, so that too is not that unusual. They're not unique in that respect. The economy has been running into difficulties, largely because of the lower oil prices, but also affected by the Western sanctions. And the Western sanctions, though, have actually in many ways strengthened President Putin, because it makes it look to the Russian people as if their economic troubles are caused by the United States and the West, and not simply by lower oil prices. And he gets credit for acting in the country's interests, in their eyes, and standing up to this.
Yeah, as you look at our relationship today between the two countries, is there a fundamental conflict that you see between the Russians and the Americans?
I don't think there is any fundamental conflict. I think that's an illusion. In fact, I think our most important values and most important interests are almost identical. The most important of all is to avoid a nuclear war. Our two countries have enough weapons that if they are used, will destroy civilization and maybe humanity itself. And we ended the Cold War on the agreement that President Reagan and Gorbachev made in their first meeting. A nuclear war cannot be won, must never be fought, which means there can be no war between us. And then we began to talk to them seriously and say, look, we can't fight each other. Why are we building all these weapons? And, you know, Gorbachev and the other leaders have said in their memoirs, this was the most powerful argument we had. That's what ended the Cold War. I think in the last 25 years, we've totally forgotten that. And like Secretary Tillerson said after his first meeting in Moscow, our relations are very bad, and that is unacceptable for the world's two great nuclear powers. The U.S. and Russia have over 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world. The use of them is the only immediate existential threat we face, and yet we forget this issue altogether. The second great interest, certainly we're both subject to terrorism from the very same groups. I mean, and then when it comes to things like global warming and other things, global warming could become an existential threat in a few decades. It's not going to be solved unless Russia is part of it. China also, for that matter. So when you look at what the real problems are, our interests are consistent and in many cases identical. But the most important one is if we are to control nuclear weapons and the proliferation, we have got to work together. And the current relationship has deteriorated to the point that there is almost no cooperation at the moment. And that is a very dangerous situation.
So how do we work together?
Well, I think the first thing we need is for our leaders to say publicly, there is no good reason for us to be enemies, and there are a lot of good reasons for us to cooperate, and then try to solve some of these problems. The United States is not going to be able to solve problems by continuing to expand NATO, particularly into areas that were once part of the Soviet Union. That's crazy, absolutely crazy. And the idea that we can transform other governments into democracies by removing their leaders, it's been proved time and time again wrong. Look what happened in Iraq. I mean, so many of our policies since the end of the Cold War have almost been designed to create enemies, particularly Russia and China. And I think the problem there is, despite President Eisenhower's advice and his farewell address about avoiding a military-industrial complex, that's what we have today. Now, we don't need a lot of carrier task forces to deal with terrorism. We don't need supersonic bombers to deal with terrorism. We need those weapons only if you've got a big enemy. And right now, the only two countries that are plausible big enemies are Russia and China. And so I think there is a real, although people don't necessarily realize this, there's a real connection between our defense budgets, our use of military means, actually, for the wrong purposes. What did we achieve by invading Iraq, which, by the way, was illegal? We lost nearly 5,000 American lives directly. We have maimed tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died. And do they have a better regime today? I mean, don't people realize that we can't be the world's lawmaker, enforcer, judge?
Sounds like you see a very crucial role for diplomacy in today's world.
Absolutely. And the point is, I don't think there are any fundamental differences in our interests and Russia's interests and our interests and China's interests. But we have to recognize that other countries do have a role to play, and they're not simply going to play by rules that we have defined and proclaimed if they don't find them convenient.
I wanted to ask you some things about the part of the current state of relations between the U.S. and Russia. Do you think that the Russians interfered in the U.S. election?
No.
Okay.
I think it's very clear. I have with me, by the way, the intelligence report. And in that first page of the intelligence report, it says the intelligence agencies are making no judgment about impact in the United States of any Russian activities. Now, if without assessing the activities, unless you assess that it had an effect, there was no interference. Second, what the report does say, yes, there was a preference for Trump. Well, okay, I don't think you need the intelligence agency to tell you that, given the relationship and the way both Secretary Clinton and President Obama had begun personally to put down the Soviet leader. But there are two other things in that report. One is that there is no evidence of interference in voting machines or vote counting. And the second is, though they think the Russians, without total proof, were behind hacking the DNC, they say that there was no falsification. So let's assume the Russians hacked it and gave it to WikiLeaks. It was the truth. How does that undermine democracy? And why would anybody vote for Trump because the DNC was rigging things for Hillary Clinton? I mean, I just don't, there's just no connection there in my mind. There has been, and I have with me, a very, I think, exhaustive article by an American political scientist, Professor Jacobson. I think he's from University of San Diego, University of California, San Diego, who analyzes the election and tells us precisely how Trump won. Partly it was the Electoral College system. Now, did the Russians create that? Partly it was the gerrymandering by Republican legislatures of things. And partly it was, I would say, faults in the Democratic campaign. And he analyzes them. He gives four different reasons. None of them have any relation to anything the Russians did. So this whole thing is just, as I watch it in Washington, is almost surreal. I think there's absolutely nothing to it. And the danger there is it is going to make it virtually impossible, not only for President Trump, but almost any president, to get us out of this dangerous situation we're in. It is definitely in our interest to improve relations with Russia. In fact, I would say it's in our vital interest.
Where do you see relations with Russia heading in the future? What do you think is
going
to happen?
Well, you know, right now the problem is if we continue our previous policies and keep hitting them with sanctions and so on. I worked 35 years in the Foreign Service to try to bring the Soviet Union into cooperation with us, into the world economy as a capitalist country, if possible, to promote business there. And now, you know, the press and Congress writes about it. Is anybody doing business with them or doing normal diplomatic things is somehow disloyal. That is close to insane. Now, I know it's driven by domestic politics and a lot of other things, but it is highly irresponsible.
Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
Jack Matlock, he was U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1987 until 1991. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show with help from Kevin Reynolds. Selena Reeder was the assistant producer. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll review and discuss the people, stories, and events that affected the tri-state this week. We'll present an in-depth look at the developments behind the headlines with editors and reporters from WVXU and other local news organizations. And we'd like to hear and share your thoughts on this week's news and how it was reported. Join us on the next Cincinnati Edition for our weekly news review, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.